KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a contractor, I don't pay for materials I don't use. So why would I pay for stuff I don't need in my mobile plan? That's why the new My Biz plan from Verizon Business is so perfect. Now I can choose exactly what I want, and I only pay for what I need.
Right now, with My Biz plan, get our best price, as low as $25 a line. Visit Verizon.com/business to get started today.
Price per month with 5+ lines. Includes auto pay and paper-free billing and special intro offer discounts. Taxes, fees, economic adjustment charge, and terms apply. Offers end June 10th, 2025.
The PC gave us computing power at home, the internet connected us, and mobile let us do it pretty much anywhere. Now generative AI lets us communicate with technology in our own language using our own senses. But figuring it all out when you're living through it is a totally different story. Welcome to Leading the Shift, a new podcast from Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. In each episode, leaders will share what they're learning to help you navigate all this change with confidence. Please join us. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Your immune system is your body's primary defense against infection and injury. Inflammation is part of that vital response, but when inflammation goes into overdrive, it can make us sick. Scientists think that many diseases have an inflammatory component. Now we are learning how a key part of that nervous system called the vagus nerve regulates the inflammatory response.
We understand how vagus nerve stimulation stops inflammation. We understand it in exquisite detail.
Could this understanding help us treat disease? Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, we explore research that suggests that stimulating this nerve network directly may alleviate or even cure chronic conditions as we go touching a nerve. When we talk about our health, certain body parts often take center stage. We refer to our brains, hearts, and stomachs when we discuss headaches, heart rates, and digestion. But there's another vital system that quietly regulates all these functions and more, and may not come up in our conversations often or at all.
The vagus nerve is a structure that runs from your brain to your body, touching virtually all of the organs in your body, so that the brain can think about your organs and you don't have to.
It's a strange and amazing part of our bodies, a pervasive nerve network that coordinates critical functions from our heartbeat to our appetite, and now, as research has shown, our immune system. And as part of the immune system, the vagus nerve regulates inflammation, which, it may be surprising to hear, underpins many diseases as diverse as rheumatoid arthritis to diabetes to Alzheimer's disease.
I'm Kevin Tracy, the president of the Feinstein Institute at Northwell Health in New York. I'm a neurosurgeon who's been fascinated by inflammation for 30 years, and I recently wrote a book called The Great Nerve about the vagus nerve.
We welcome Dr. Tracy back to Big Picture Science to talk about the role of the vagus nerve in health. A pioneer in the study of the great nerve for 2 decades, he discovered the inflammatory reflex, the neural pathway by which the vagus nerve regulates the immune system. And he has studied how stimulation of the vagus nerve can treat inflammation and autoimmune diseases. Along with his new book, he brings us an update. By the end of this year, the FDA is poised to approve a vagus nerve stimulation, or VNS, device that he developed for treating rheumatoid arthritis. And if approved, it would mark the first autoimmune disease approved for treatment with such a device, joining VNS therapies approved for epilepsy and depression. In this episode, we'll discuss the difference between good and bad inflammation, the role that inflammation plays in disease, and the promising future of vagus nerve stimulation as treatment. But first, Dr. Tracy introduces us to the expansive vagus nerve system. And here's the thing. You may be more familiar with it than you think. When you say something like, "I have a bad feeling in my stomach," you are referring to it.
Absolutely. Your stomach, your entire GI system, your liver, your pancreas, your duodenum, jejunum, and colon. The vagus nerve has a crucial role in the gut-vagus brain axis. The vagus nerve has fibers that run in both directions. So sensations in your intestines are transmitted to your central nervous system, to your brain, because 80% of the fibers in the vagus nerve carry information from the body up into the brain. The other 20%, of course, carry reflex responses, reflex information from the brain back to your intestines and to your other organs.
Let's paint a picture of what this vagus nerve and its network look like, because it is extensive. Now, I don't know if it's more helpful to think of it as parallel tree trunks, because there are actually two vagus nerves, with a branching root system, or if you prefer, fiber optics. But what does it look like and where does it start?
There are, as you say, two vagus nerves. You have one on each side of your body, like you have two thumbs and two kidneys. It starts at the base of your brain, at about the level of your eardrums, and it runs down across your neck into your chest on both sides and then continues on into your abdomen. But as you say, along the way, it's sending out branches in all directions, touching all the organs you never think about all day long. The best picture I've seen of the vagus nerve to imagine in your mind's eye is a famous ink drawing from centuries ago. If you imagine a brain and the vagus nerves dangling below it, it almost looks like a jellyfish.
Okay. And jellyfish wasn't on my list here. I had the root system and the fiber optics, but I like jellyfish.
It's almost like a Portuguese man of war where the body of the jellyfish is the brain. And there are so many fibers that you said a few minutes ago, on each side you have one vagus nerve trunk, but inside of each trunk, in humans anyways, you have about 100,000 fibers. So when someone talks to me and says, oh, I want to stimulate my vagus nerve, I say, oh, really? Which one?
Mm-hmm. And this is what's mind-boggling, among the many things that are mind-boggling, is that each one of those fibers, or maybe it's more than one fiber, contributes to a specific function in the body, like regulating the spleen, the heart, immunity. That's why there are so many of them, because there's a lot to regulate.
100% correct. Evolution over hundreds of millions of years has selected the path and the function and the job description, if you will, of each of those 200,000 fibers. Now, my colleagues in my lab at the Feinstein Institute, friends and collaborators at other universities around the world, people like Steven Lieberlis, are just now breaking down the identity of each and every individual fiber. We're doing this in mice because it's possible to do these kinds of things in the lab that you can't do in human clinical research. But as we learn more and more about it, it seems that very small numbers of fibers have very specific functions. So, for instance, in a mouse anyways, which has about 5,000 fibers, not 200,000, but only around 100 fibers are used to control breathing. Think about that for a second. There's 5,000 fibers. That means there's 4,900 more fibers, and only 100 are needed for breathing. It was quite surprising when we realized that. In humans, for instance, we've discovered that probably as few as a few hundred or a few thousand fibers are all you need to actually shut off the inflammatory response in your body. So the amount of precision in this network is remarkable.
You know what it reminds me of is the surprise that scientists had when decoding the human genome. They realized that we didn't have as many genes as we thought we might, but also that just a few genes would regulate certain functions. And it feels like this kind of decoding is similar to that in trying to understand, you know, this vast network. It's not genes you're looking at, it's fibers, but trying to understand what they do.
It is. It is like that. It's a very good analogy that I hadn't thought of before. You can carry that analogy further, because what we're talking about is how information is encoded and decoded in the genome, as you say. And in the case of the vagus nerve isn't so much storing the information. I think that's often misrepresented in social media and in internet postings. I mean, you can imagine how much is misrepresented. There are billions of web impressions and social media posts, so there's a lot out there. The vagus nerve is transmitting information. So what's so remarkable about this is that there's 200,000 fibers. And as far as we can tell, each and every one of those fibers is transmitting a different kind of signal. Another analogy is the transatlantic cable. So you've got cables running under the ocean from New York to Europe and from California to Asia. And submarines will park on these cables and they will listen in on the signals. And they can, although there's at any one time, there may be millions or hundreds of millions of signals passing back and forth, the submarine can figure out which one's a telephone call and they listen to it, and which one's a movie and they can watch it. Now, we're just beginning to do that for the vagus nerve knowledge.
Now, you said that it is a communication system and that 80% of the signals are traveling upward toward the brain and 20% are regulations coming from the brain. So, Kevin, is the brain controlling things, or is the vagus nerve controlling things, or can you not separate the two?
You can't separate the two. So there's a tendency in a lot of sort of self-help teaching, there's a tendency in general for people to anthropomorphize. They say, well, we have this powerful brain and it's in charge and it's constantly sending signals down to the body telling it what to do. Well, sort of. Actually, what's happening is the brain is receiving an enormous amount of information from all of your organs. How much glucose is present in your liver, how fast your intestines are propelling food, how much urine you're making, how much bile you're making in your gallbladder, and how much insulin you're releasing from your pancreas. All of this information is coming in as neurological signals, many of them traveling up the vagus nerve. And through these specific fibers that we talked about, each and every one of those individual fibers is now interacting with neurons in the brainstem and brain, enabling the brain to send specific directions back down into the body to correct or modulate the output of these organ systems. And when everything's in perfect balance and the reflexes are coordinated and harmonious, we call that homeostasis. And the organs are functioning in a beautiful kind of harmony. You could also call it health.
What's particularly amazing is that this is all going on without our conscious awareness. You describe the simple or not so simple act of eating and how the vagus nerve is preparing all these organs, the esophagus, the stomach, the pancreas, to receive food and then communicating throughout the body without our conscious awareness. Can you just give an example of what it's doing to prepare us for the simple act of eating a slice of pizza?
It's a remarkable symphony of individual reflexes that allows that to happen. So as you put a piece of pizza in your mouth, or as you smell the pizza before you put it in your mouth, the incoming signals of smell are sensory signals. So that means signals traveling into the brain. The brain will send signals to your vagus nerve and other nerves that innervate your salivary glands, and you begin to salivate even before you've had a bite of pizza just because you smelled it. That can even happen by thinking about it. Thinking about pizza is another sort of input to the brain that would cause these reflex outputs. It's quite remarkable. At every step of the way, you can add another reflex. So you put the pizza in your mouth and begin chewing. The sensation of pizza in your mouth activates sensory neurons in your mouth that relay not only the taste of the pizza, but the temperature of the pizza and the density or the feeling of the pizza in your mouth, the pressure against your teeth. All of these sensory signals are reported into your brain through sensory nerves.
And that's the vagus network.
Many of them are vagus nerve in your mouth. Many of the sensory fibers are vagus nerve, and there are other nerves as well, the trigeminal nerve and other nerves. But together, these signals arrive into your brainstem, and the brain sends signals down the vagus nerve to begin producing acid in your stomach and to begin the muscular functions of the propelling food down the food chain in your GI tract and of opening and closing the various sphincters along the way. It's a highly orchestrated dance of reflexes.
Let's identify what form these signals take, because sometimes they're described as chemical and sometimes they're described as electrical. But I think what's happening is that the nerves are converting electrical signals into chemical ones. Can you just briefly summarize what's happening?
It's important here to understand that we're somewhat restricted by the semantics. If you look at the definitions of electricity that we all learned in high school physics, electricity is the product or is the function of voltage and current and resistance. And just like when you flick on the light switch in your kitchen, the light comes on almost instantaneously. We all are taught and understand that the electric current flowing through the copper wires travels at speed of light-like speeds. That's not how nerves work. There's a real difference here. When nerves relay signals, they do so by firing voltage-controlled ion channels. What does that mean? It means that little pores in the side of the neuron open, and ions like chloride and sodium rush in and potassium rush in and out of the neuron. And this rushing in and out of the ions causes a voltage spike. And that voltage spike begins the information chain. Because what happens is the appearance of a voltage spike at one part of the neuron causes down the wire a little ways, down the neuron a little ways, it causes another voltage-gated ion channel to open. And this continues all the way down the nerve fiber like dominoes, one after the other. And it's fast in biologic terms, but it's nowhere near the speed of light. It's a tiny, small fraction of the speed of light. It's much slower. And so it's not the same as putting in an electric current where electrons race down the copper wire. It's completely different. It requires energy. Each of these ion channels has to use a little ATP, and it requires a sequential firing of these voltage-gated ion channels. At the end of the line, the arrival of these voltage spikes cause the neuron to release a chemical signal, a neurotransmitter, which then diffuses across a narrow gap called the synapse. And it's the arrival of the chemical at the responding cell or structure, that's what triggers the biological response. So it's very different than electricity.
Mm-hmm. But it's important to understand if we are going to at all tap into it or change the health or improve our health through that electrical, can I call it electrical current?
I would call it if we're going to improve those neural signals.
But then we do have to understand that they are trafficking in electricity and chemicals.
I would say we can use electric devices or bioelectronic devices to deliver electric charge or electric current into a nerve to stimulate the nerve to fire its own signals in a natural way. But the only way we can do that is by applying this electric current in bursts, very short bursts, a few hundred microseconds. So we put in a burst of electricity for 300 microseconds and then turn it off and then wait for a little bit and then do it again. And it's that repetitive stimulation with very short bursts of electricity that bring the neuron to life. And now the neuron is actually doing its neuron thing. It's not sending electric current, it's sending voltage spikes.
Next, neurosurgeon Kevin Tracy describes the health benefits of tapping into the vagus nerve and how his team reacted when they discovered that it helps regulate our immune system.
It was a big surprise because the immune system was viewed as a separate, almost firewalled system from the nervous system.
We're looking at how we might improve our health by touching a nerve on Big Picture Science.
Hilton brings you new ways to stay, with experiences that let you capture the glory days. Introducing the Graduate Hotels. Each inspired by local college towns, these stays are always original and never boring. Get in touch with traditions all across the country and enjoy a stay that's a class above the rest. Book at Graduate Hotels with Hilton Honors Points at Hilton.com. It's a win-win. Hilton, for the stay.
One of the many functions that the brain and the vagus nerve network regulate is inflammation. Now, we depend on inflammation, of course. It's crucial in helping us recover from injury or illness, but it can also go haywire. The role of runaway inflammation in causing disease is the research focus of neurosurgeon Kevin Tracy, whose team discovered the inflammatory reflex. Dr. Tracy is the author of The Great Nerve, The New Science of the Vagus Nerve and How to Harness Its Healing Reflexes. And he describes why learning the role that the great nerve plays in regulating inflammation came as a surprise.
At the time we discovered the vagus nerve function almost like the brakes on your car, slowing down inflammation, like the brakes in your car slow your car from barreling down the mountain. My colleagues and I discovered that the vagus nerve signals were slowing inflammation and preventing it from racing out of control. If inflammation races out of control, it can cause severe damage even to normal organs. It was a big surprise because the immune system was viewed as a separate, almost firewalled system from the nervous system. The immune system, you know, many of its cells, like your white blood cells, are floating around in your bloodstream. And your nerves, on the other hand, have these terminations, like we just described, in various tissues, so that individual nerve fibers can send highly specific signals to individual cells. So it came as a huge surprise that there would be a reflex mechanism that today we call the vagus nerve inflammatory reflex. Now, this came as quite a surprise when we proposed this and then proved it to be true.
Well, we should talk then about what inflammation is, because, of course, it is a part of our immune system and it helps protect us. And there are seems like there's lots of different immune responses depending on the disease or the injury, like a bee sting is different from, breaking your leg or something like that. And as you said, the problem is it can go haywire. So how does it distinguish between healthy immune responses and the ones where it is going out of control? So what does it mean that it's regulating the inflammatory response?
Inflammation is the redness, the heat, the pain, and the swelling that occurs after either an infection or an injury. So an infected pimple or a sprained ankle, they both cause inflammation. Why? Well, those responses are caused by the appearance of the arrival of white blood cells on the scene of the injury or the infection. And that's a good thing. Inflammation starts off as a very good thing. In the case of infection, the white blood cells can eradicate the bacteria or the virus and restore balance there. And in the case of an injury, the white blood cells come in and clean up the injured tissue and also mobilize stem cells and help in the healing process. So far, so good. What happens sometimes in some chronic diseases is the inflammation doesn't stop. And if the inflammation persists and does not resolve for weeks or months or years, that inflammation actually damages normal tissue. And you end up with things like kidney damage in lupus, or you end up with damaged joints in rheumatoid arthritis, or a damaged brain in Alzheimer's disease. Now, over hundreds of millions of years, the immune system and the brain developed a collaborative reflex system to help suppress excessive inflammation. And so when the vagus nerve signals the inflammatory reflex to slow inflammation, it doesn't turn it off. It doesn't stop it 100%. It just prevents the excessive inflammation that causes damage.
Let's talk more about the association of inflammation with these diseases, because listeners may be surprised, or I should say I was surprised in reading your book and reading the diverse and the numerous diseases that are associated with inflammation. You name some of them. You have Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, epilepsy, diabetes. And this seems strange, Kevin, because it seems as though they would have different etiologies, you know, different causes. So does the inflammation come in because where there's disease or injury, you have inflammation, or is it that the inflammation is contributing, creating these conditions? Like, could inflammation itself trigger Parkinson's disease?
In these conditions, you're absolutely right. They all have different causes and they all have different progressions that we call pathogenesis, or different mechanisms by which the disease progresses and develops and causes damage. Let's start with what everybody knows. If you have an autoimmune condition, such as rheumatoid arthritis, and you have the red, painful, swollen, tender joints, no one would be surprised to say that that's inflammation. But soon after that, when you move to thinking about what inflammation means in these other conditions, we once again have a semantic problem. So when you look in the brain of an Alzheimer's patient, you see some changes in the brain with inflammatory cells, for instance, or the production of inflammatory molecules like cytokines, which you would call inflammation in the tender red swollen joint. But the brain is not tender and it's not red and it's not swollen, but that is the hallmark definition of inflammation. So it's almost as if we need better definitions based on the condition we're talking about. Well, why is this so important? Because if you look at the leading conditions that challenge the survival of the human species today, whether it's heart disease and stroke, whether it's cancer, neurodegeneration, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, obesity, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, in all of those cases, inflammation either has some role in causing it or has some role in making it worse. So, for instance, in the case of Parkinson's disease, whether or not inflammation causes Parkinson's is not proved, but it's a hypothesis that many people are studying in laboratory experiments. For instance, there's evidence in Parkinson's that a protein that travels from the gut up the vagus nerve into the brain may have a crucial role in causing the death of neurons in the brain that make dopamine, and or a crucial role in causing some kind of inflammation in the brain that kills the dopamine-producing cells. This is all being intensely debated and studied as people try to figure out how this works. The point isn't that we have all the answers about the role of inflammation in all these conditions. The point is people like my colleagues and I are asking questions that can be tested in the lab, and that's the fundamental basis of science. Ask the right questions, make a hypothesis, and do the right experiments to produce new information that one day may benefit patients.
So is the idea here that if you could prevent inflammation, you could either prevent or reverse disease?
That is another hypothesis that many people are addressing. So for instance, in pancreas cancer, the risk of pancreas cancer increases significantly in patients who have chronic pancreatitis. So there's a simple question. If we had a way of eradicating inflammation or treating it in the future better than we treat it today, in patients with chronic pancreatitis, which is chronic inflammation of the pancreas, could we reduce the risk of those patients getting cancer? And the list goes on and on and on. Preceding chronic inflammation increases the risk for many different types of cancer. So that's one approach. Another approach would be in the cardiovascular system. There's clear evidence that the progression of lesions in the coronary arteries in the heart or the cerebral vascular arteries in the brain, that the progression of atherosclerosis is accelerated by or made worse by the presence of inflammatory cells in the linings of these arteries. So the question is, if that's a type of inflammation, once again, it's not red, full, painful, swollen, and tender, but if it's a type of inflammatory process that we could treat better or control, could we slow or improve the number of heart attacks or the severity of heart attacks and strokes? It's a reasonable hypothesis.
I do need to follow up on the role of inflammation in depression, because I can visualize, I can picture the role of inflammation in all the diseases that we've been talking about, but it's hard to picture how inflammation could contribute to daily mood variation or depression. And can you just give us an overview? We may have to summarize this, but this will be very intriguing to a lot of people who either struggle with depression or know people who do, that inflammation plays a role.
Let me give you a concrete example that's so simple, I don't think it's easy to forget. The last time you had the flu or COVID, you probably recall that you were fatigued. You lost interest in your hobbies and in maybe even in your loved ones. You just wanted to be left alone in bed and didn't want to eat. Those responses, that fatigue and anorexia and social withdrawal, those are all caused by cytokines. Cytokines like TNF and IL-1 and IL-6. Cytokines are produced by white blood cells. The production of cytokines is almost always associated with the presence of inflammation. Now, in the laboratory, I have, and this has been done by others around the world, have administered cytokines to patients or volunteers as part of research projects. The administration of cytokines into the bloodstream causes those features of depression. So we know this. This has been known for decades. Now the question becomes, we've implanted vagus nerve stimulators in patients with depression and half of them get better, and we don't know why. I've asked the question, is it possible that the beneficial effects of vagus nerve stimulation in some patients with depression is caused by reducing the burden of cytokines in their body? It's possible. No one knows. It's not proved. It's a testable hypothesis. it's very difficult to actually do these experiments. It requires a lot of money, and it requires something else that we don't have consensus on. We don't have a consensus agreement among scientists and physicians on how to measure inflammation as a chronic problem. So there are some markers people use, like CRP and IL-6, but there's no evidence that they're the same as hemoglobin A1C. In other words, the chronic marker of chronic glucose exposure. So we have difficulty assigning different kinds of depression into different clinical groups. We have difficulty measuring the amount of inflammation in the body, and you can't put a vagus nerve stimulator in everybody to do these experiments without significant ethical, regulatory, and financial barriers. So these are fair questions. We don't have good answers, but I'd like to see more work being done on this.
When you describe the role of cytokines in triggering inflammation and depression, as human beings, we are somewhat at the mercy or vulnerable to all the chemicals inside of us, all these processes that some of them we can control, some of them we can't. It's a terrible thing to struggle with depression, and some ways you're at the mercy of things that are happening in the brain that are just outside your control. Maybe I'm making an obvious statement, but it does highlight in some ways how vulnerable we are.
Life is a harmony of complex systems that go from the level of the things we can see, like our organs and their function, down to the individual cells that make up the organ, into the cells where you have metabolism regulating the energy of each and every cell that's exchanged between all those organs, down to the level of individual molecules like glucose and cytokines. And so the individual molecules produce the harmony of life and the joys and wonders of life, and they also do produce the pain and the suffering and the disease. The role of the nervous system in one way can be thought of as inseparable from these processes, because it's like the maestro controlling the songs from all the individual instruments in the orchestra, and it controls it through reflexes, many of them traveling in the vagus nerve.
So we have many metaphors to choose from to describe the vagus nervous system in our body. It resembles either a branching tree or perhaps a jellyfish, and coordinates and regulates essential functions in our body, including the immune response, like a maestro. And now the conductor may have some assistance. Up next, what it's like to insert an electronic capsule into your neck and the clinically proven benefits of doing so.
The device today is about the size of a multivitamin or a fish oil pill, and it's implanted in the front of your neck, right near your Adam's apple.
We hope this episode of Big Picture Science hits the spot, but it is touching a nerve.
USAA knows dynamic duos can save the day, like superheroes and sidekicks, or auto and home insurance. With USAA, you can bundle your auto and home and save up to 10%. Visit usaa.com/bundle.
Bundle savings are off total premium, not available in all states or in all situations. To qualify, auto policy must be active prior to property policy issue, subject to change. Restrictions apply. Membership eligibility and product restrictions apply and are subject to change. USAA means United Services Automobile Association and its affiliates, San Antonio, Texas.
The big question regarding vagus nerve stimulation, or VNS therapy, is whether it could potentially replace traditional anti-inflammatory drugs. When we spoke with neurosurgeon Kevin Tracy, he was awaiting FDA approval for his company's device designed to treat rheumatoid arthritis, an autoimmune disease. The key issue is whether SetPoint's device, similar in many ways to the VNS devices currently used to treat epilepsy, is as effective, or perhaps even more so, than leading rheumatoid arthritis medications. But Dr. Tracy wasn't the first to zap the vagus nerve with an electrical impulse. That credit goes to the American neurologist James Corning in the 1880s. A century later, in 1988, a VNS device was first implanted in a patient to treat epilepsy. Dr. Tracy reflects on what we've learned from these early milestones separated by 100 years and what we've learned since.
Upwards of 250,000 patients worldwide, maybe more, treated with vagus nerve stimulators over the last 30 or 40 years. The FDA first approved vagus nerve stimulation in the 1990s to treat patients with epilepsy that was not responding to medical therapy. Now, this was based on work originally in Pisa, Italy, and later out of Philadelphia by investigators that noticed in laboratory models of epilepsy in cats and in other animals that if the vagus nerve was stimulated with electricity, that the epileptic seizure could be interrupted. And the idea was that applying bursts of electricity in the vagus nerve in the neck was sending sensory signals or incoming signals into the brain that was activating networks that was somehow stabilizing the seizure activity. Now, they didn't know how it worked, and even now today, we don't know how that works.
Are some ideas that it's like a resetting of the vagus nerve? Should we think of it that way? Is it, you use the word interruption, or it's interrupting a destructive process, and maybe then the body has a chance in that window to get back to homeostasis? Do we have some idea of how it might be working?
I think when we think of set points or resetting, I think of resetting the activity in the brain, not in the vagus nerve. I view the vagus nerve like the wire that is bringing the incoming information into the brain. And inside the brain are thermostats, like the thermostats in your house. Now, those establish a set point. And when the temperature in your house, which can be thought of as information coming in through the vagus nerve to the thermostat, when those temperatures change in the body, the response in the brain is gauged or regulated by what is the set point on the thermostat. That's how I view the set points, in the brain, not in the vagus nerve.
Mm-hmm. Now, you founded a company, Set Point Medical, which was able to build a VNS device. Can we talk about how that works and where you have implanted them? Now, it's my understanding, and I'm pointing to the back of my neck here, that they're either implanted in the kind of the back of the neck here or under the collarbone in the front, or where are they implanted? And what exactly are you implanting?
Yeah. So in 2007, I started a company called SetPoint Medical. Full disclosure, I am continuing as a consultant to that company, but I'm not an insider in the company. I don't have inside knowledge, and my opinions on this talk with you are my own. But the simple answer is the vagus nerve stimulator that was developed by SetPoint was made in order to test the question of whether we could stop inflammation in patients with rheumatoid arthritis, as we've been able to do successfully in my laboratory for many, many years. The device today is about the size of a multivitamin or a fish oil pill, and it's implanted in the front of your neck, right near your Adam's apple, right about at the spot where you can feel your carotid pulse. It's implanted through a very small incision, an inch or an inch and a half long, and once it's implanted in a procedure that lasts about an hour or an hour and a half, give or take, that device becomes invisible because it's deep under the muscles of your neck, your strap muscles or your sternocleidomastoid. Once it's in place, it sits on the vagus nerve. The device contains, in this very small device, it contains a computer chip, it contains a battery which is fully rechargeable, it contains an antenna to communicate with the doctor's tablet, and it contains a lead or a contact surface that sits on the vagus nerve. And it's through these leads that these electrical pulses travel for 1 minute a day. 1 minute a day in the clinical trial that SetPoint reported last November at the American College of Rheumatology in Washington. 1 minute a day was sufficient to put patients into statistically significant clinical responses. Now,
and do they, just to follow up on that, do they feel it? Do you have 1 minute in the day where you just feel like a little bit of a buzz in your neck?
Many of these treatments were done at 4:30 in the morning, and many of the patients did not feel it. In fact, many of the patients slept through it. If patients were awake or if it awakened them, it feels like a little buzz in the neck or in the throat. It's possible in some patients to have a little twitching of the lip, or if they're speaking, to have a little vibration in their voice, but that lasts for 1 minute.
Goodness. You said one pulse for 1 minute once a day in this case, but I guess it would be different for different, depending on what you're treating. And then how long do you keep the device in, Kevin? Is it something you have to keep in for the rest of your life?
The device is implanted for either for life or until a surgeon takes it out again. Many of the existing vagus nerve stimulating devices for epilepsy are implanted for many years or decades. So there's a tremendous clinical experience about the safety of vagus nerve stimulation. Here's what we know. We know that it doesn't cause immunosuppression. We know that there's no black box warnings. We know that it doesn't cost $100,000 a year every year, like the current therapies for rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune conditions. So there is a ways to go still. After this first clinical trial in the U.S., it was designed and performed as a registration trial for the FDA. The FDA is currently reviewing some 18,000 pages of data from that trial and from other trials, and will make a decision in the coming months, hopefully soon. I'm hoping, I don't know, of course, I'm hoping that this leads to the availability of vagus nerve stimulation in the U.S. for patients with severe rheumatoid arthritis who are not gaining significant clinical benefit from all the other available therapies. I mean, that's really an important point. Some people who've looked at the data from the clinical trial are quick to say, well, I wish there was a bigger effect. And I say, yeah, me too. However, there are patients in this trial who were out of options. All of the available drugs that were prescribed for these patients failed to help them. And so the fact that there were any responders is in itself remarkable. The fact that many of these patients are now taking no medication is remarkable. And the fact that patients who have been on medications for years and years and years are now taking smaller doses of these medications is remarkable. Now, it's also not surprising that this didn't cure everybody, and there are patients in that trial who gained no benefit whatsoever. But that's true of all medical therapies. There's always patients who do really well, patients who do pretty well, and patients who gain no benefit. And so that's what we'll learn in the long run as more and more patients are treated in this way. And I predict that is essentially a near and present future.
Is a VNS then a little bit like having a pacemaker?
In some ways. I mean, there's different kinds of pacemakers and there's different kinds of defibrillators. I'm not aware that any of them only work for 1 minute a day.
And does it put you in an uncomfortable position as a scientist, or how does one reconcile watching the remarkable effects of stimulating the vagus nerve in terms of helping a person get over a disease or heal or feel better, not feel pain anymore, and not being able to say exactly how it works?
I would actually say we know extraordinarily well how it works. I would actually argue to say that we understand how vagus nerve stimulation stops inflammation better than we understand how FDA-approved drugs like anti-TNF antibodies stop inflammation. We understand it in exquisite detail.
I'm going to take it back. You do know how it works.
Absolutely.
I think we were talking about epilepsy. And maybe in that case, that is when you said we're not quite sure how that works. I just wanted to be clear that was perhaps a single case or isolated case.
It's really interesting. Your comments are especially interesting because in the two cases of FDA approval for implanted vagus nerve stimulation, well, there's three. The first is epilepsy. We don't know how it works, and it works about half the time. The second is for treating depression, and we don't know how it works in severe depressed patients, and it works about half the time. The third is a recent FDA approval for implanted vagus nerve stimulators, and that is to improve the rehabilitation and recovery in patients who've had a stroke affecting their arm. We know a tremendous amount about how that works. Outstanding work from Texas by Michael Kilgard and his colleagues has showed that by pairing the stimulus with the rehabilitation of the arm, that you get significantly better long-term functional outcome. In inflammation, I would argue we know how the vagus nerve turns off inflammation as well or better than as we understand how many anti-inflammatory drugs work.
You have long recognized the healing potential of the vagus nerve, and I'm wondering if you're getting pushback for your ideas and for advocating for bioelectric medicine or for stimulating the vagus nerve. For example, I could see you getting it from perhaps the mainstream psychiatric community, which is often very drug-focused.
I think that there is not a lot of pushback right now, believe it or not. I think if you look at the history of medicine for revolutionary new ideas, which arguably this would be to use a computer chip instead of a pill or an injection, in the history of truly new ideas, patients drive the change. And what we know so far about patients taking drugs that they have to inject, drugs that cost $100,000 a year and have dangerous side effects, including sepsis and cancer and immunosuppression. These patients are interested, encouraged, and hopeful, and would welcome the chance, many of them, to have a computer chip implanted in a one-hour procedure rather than have to take these other medications at these expensive costs. I think the pushback will be it's going to be against changing workflows in an entire medical system. Rheumatologists don't typically think of a surgical implant of a computer chip to treat their patients, nor do psychiatrists. Neurosurgeons and other surgeons who may be implanting this device are not routinely doing this type of a procedure. They're going to have to learn how to implant this new device. The payers on the insurance and on the government side are going to have to understand the cost savings that this offers for a single intervention. These are important, complex decisions.
Well, if we look ahead to the potential for the healing properties of the vagus nerve, you and other scientists have identified the function in some of those vagus nerve fibers, as you said in the beginning of our conversation. But there are many that we don't understand. We don't know what they do. What function might they have? And what does that suggest about the potential for future therapies if we do identify those functions?
This is an enormous opportunity for ongoing research in looking at new therapies to treat diabetes, for instance. Can we put the fibers that control insulin release under the control of a device? Can we put the nerve fibers to the liver that control the release of glucagon or actually control the metabolism of the cells that release glucose from the liver? Can we put those under the control of a device? Can we build a device? It's been tried in the past and hasn't withstood the test of time, but is there a way to build devices that target the fibers in the vagus nerve that send signals of fullness to the brain so that we feel full or less hungry after a smaller meal? Are there ways of changing the metabolism in muscle cells to reduce insulin resistance, which is a critical component, of course, of the obesity epidemic and of the type of diabetes that affects obesity. The list goes on and on and on. The opportunities are absolutely enormous. It may be possible in some of these cases when we know more to build non-invasive devices, maybe focused ultrasound devices to strap on your side using built-in artificial intelligence to guide the ultrasound to the vagus nerve in the liver, where you can activate glucose-sensitive neurons to cause both weight loss and better glucose control. We've done this in the laboratory, in laboratory mice. There are ongoing clinical trials of this question. So we don't have all the answers yet, but what's so important about these questions is they're not pie in the sky. They're not 20 years away. These are testable hypotheses that could be looked at in clinical studies and in laboratory studies that could be happening in some places as we speak and in other places just around the corner.
What's the strangest or maybe most amusing regulatory function that scientists have identified with the vagus nerve?
I was most surprised a long time ago, maybe 20 years, when I came across work done in Europe and replicated in other centers since then, that driving signals up the vagus nerve on the sensory side into the brain enhances learning and memory. That surprised me. There's not a lot of talk about it these days, but I think it's probably a really important unanswered question.
Boy, I would like to stimulate that memory vagus nerve fiber.
A lot of people would.
From time to time. Well, then finally, Kevin, how can we all in order to maintain good health, how can we keep our vagus nerve and its fibers happy and healthy without using a VNS device? Are there things that we could be doing to keep our vagus nerve and its fibers happy and healthy?
The interesting answer to your question is that the many things that are associated with or correlated with improving vagus nerve tone, if you will, are the things that your primary care physician and probably your grandmother told you to do and are telling you to do. Eat a balanced diet, get enough rest, exercise regularly, try to minimize excessive anxiety in your life, and try to maintain strong interpersonal relationships and a sense of purpose. These things are all associated with, in clinical studies, some of them very large and very well controlled, they're all associated with increased vagal tone as measured by either slower resting heart rates or increased heart rate variability, which is one measure of vagus tone. So that's all good. Those are the healthy lifestyle choices that are encouraged to everyone and anyone. What's interesting to me is we don't completely understand why those things increase vagal tone, you know? And when you measure vagal tone as a slowing heart rate or increased heart rate variability, you're looking at the fibers in the vagus nerve that go to the heart. And many of those things are associated with decreased inflammation. That's also good. But does that mean that when you stimulate the fibers to the heart, you're also stimulating the fibers to the spleen that turn off inflammation? I'm not sure. It's yet another scientific question.
Well, if we're including my grandmother's advice for what'll keep you happy and young, it would be eat more pie.
Not sure that what that would do to your heart rate variability. You should probably check with your doctor first.
No, but it does make you very happy to say. Well, Kevin Tracy, it was a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was great to be here. Thank you for having me on, Molly.
Kevin Tracy is a neurosurgeon and president and CEO of the Feinstein Institutes for Medical Research, a part of Northwell Health in New York, who has been a lead figure in the field of bioelectric medicine. He is the author of The Great Nerve, The New Science of the Vagus Nerve and How to Harness Its Healing Reflexes. This show would not be possible without the steady nerves of astronomer and producer Seth Shostak, senior producer Gary Niederhoff, and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science. Also, a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters. The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science that examines the role of the vagus nerve in maintaining good health is called Touching a Nerve.
Are you thinking of getting an in-demand degree that will set you apart in the Seattle job market? At WGU, you can earn a supply chain and operations bachelor's degree online and around your current schedule. Designed with input from industry experts, you'll learn at the speed of business and be prepared to work for a vast range of employers, helping an organization make smarter, quicker, and more efficient decisions. Discover how you can earn the skills needed to make an immediate impact at wgu.edu/Seattle.
Part telenovela, part whodunit, and all heart. Laughs in Spanish is this spring's must-see comedy. Marnie's career-defining art show turns to chaos when the paintings go missing in her Miami gallery. Add a movie star mom, a catering catastrophe, and a high school crush, and you've got the wildest day ever. Featuring a local artist showcase in the lobby, Laughs in Spanish will have you laughing 1 minute and wanting to hug your mom the next. Laughs in Spanish, a comedy in English, starts April 17th. Tickets start at just $25. Visit seattlerep.org for details.
Died today, you saw the face of God and love. Would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low, you cannot fall. Would you change? Would you change?
bad, how good does it need to get? How many losses, how much regret? What chain reaction would cause an effect? Makes you turn around, makes you try to explain, makes you forgive and forget, makes you change.
somehow.